This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
I know what we're looking at for this economy. You? We will tell you what we know on the program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, today, I do believe the 29th of September. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. Our lead story today is a tale of a balancing act of retailers in this economy trying to overcome a simply terrible first three quarters of the year by finishing strong. You will hear elsewhere in the program today of indicators we're watching to educate our guesses about where things are going. But a report from the accounting consulting firm BDO shows 29 big retailers filed for bankruptcy protection in this economy through August, and that if things continue at that pace, we will match 2010, the dark days after the Great Recession. So for all the retailers still getting by, the last 3 months of the coming year, that is this year, are going to be even more critical than usual as they go looking for some hope in the holidays. Marketplace's Justin Ho starts us off.
The report found that bankrupt retailers have closed almost 6,000 stores this year. Retailers that have seen the most bankruptcies sell apparel, shoes, products we just haven't been buying much of during the pandemic. Stores and malls have been especially hard hit.
You've got 800 or 900 stores spread across malls in the United States. You probably need about half that many stores.
Brian Yarbrough is an analyst with Edward Jones. He says the big box retailers are spending more to attract consumers who just aren't going to the mall and want to shop online.
You're seeing the Walmarts and the Targets of the world invest billions of dollars a year in technology. These small companies can't keep up.
But many retailers rely on their physical locations and are struggling to stay competitive and attract shoppers during a critical holiday season. David Berliner at BDO says that could include services like contactless checkout or in-store pickup for online orders.
Whatever they can do to make consumers feel safe going into these brick-and-mortar stores.
Berliner says what retailers need to figure out is what makes sense for a physical store to be profitable.
To make sure the brick-and-mortar stores are in the right place, the right size store. You know, I think stores could be smaller now than was designed years ago.
Berliner says the pandemic has just accelerated a trend of store closures throughout the U.S. That's because, he says, the country has been overstored for years. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
After the debate this evening, oh, by the way, there's a debate this evening, Joe Biden is going to start a campaign swing through Ohio and Pennsylvania tomorrow morning, and he is going to do it by train. We bring this up because earlier this month, Amtrak's CEO, William Flynn is his name, he told Congress that the railroad needs another $2.8 billion in fresh federal funding to help make up for pandemic losses. And in the meanwhile, Amtrak is planning to cut back a lot of its long-distance routes from daily departures to three times a week. Marketplace's Andy Euler has this look at infrastructure economics on the rails.
Technically, Amtrak is a for-profit business.
But it's really run more like a public service.
That's John MacHumber at the Harvard Business School.
It has a material subsidy each year from the federal government of equal to about a third of its operating revenues.
That material subsidy is about $2 billion. Before the pandemic, Amtrak's finances weren't all that bad. In fact, last November, it announced its smallest ever operating loss of about $30 million. Baruch Feigenbaum is with the Reason Foundation.
With COVID-19, our ridership is down significantly.
Down 80% from a year ago, and that's why Amtrak's planning to furlough 10% of its workforce and cut some long-distance services, like trains that travel from San Antonio to Chicago or Seattle to Los Angeles.
Amtrak's long-distance service loses a lot of money, even in the best of times, and so now we're talking about really significant losses that they just cannot sustain.
Amtrak already got $1 billion in COVID relief money. Feigenbaum says additional federal funding just isn't a good investment. But Jim Matthews with the Rail Passengers Association says Amtrak's service cuts could cost the interior regions of the country billions.
When that ridership falls, everything that goes along with that ridership falls with it. The tourism spending, the restaurant spending, anything that benefits from those riders gets cut.
So he says Congress should step up with additional funding. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Little bumpy in equities today. Details, numbers, you know the drill. We are a week officially today into fall, which for those in the flower business usually marks the end of the slow summer season as things get busy heading into the holidays. This year, though, as we are all too well aware, things are anything but usual, especially for Christina Stembel. She is the CEO and founder of a direct-to-consumer flower company called Farm Girl Flowers. We've talked to her a couple of times this year, including, as it happens, today. Christina, it's good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me, Kai. Pleasure to be here.
Where have we gotten you? Because you're not where you were last time we talked.
I am not. I'm down in Ecuador, near Quito, actually, doing a supply chain trip, planning for our growth next year. And now is the time to be planning for planting season with our growers down here.
Speaking of growth for next year, this year turned out, we had you on back around Mother's Day, this year turned out to be pretty good for you, unexpectedly so.
Yeah. This year, you know, when we talked last, we had just gotten through a really good Mother's Day, and we were just so grateful and counting our blessings from that. And then was, you know, really concerned about summer. Summer's always a, you know, much harder time for us. Sales usually go down 30 to 50% during the summer months. And we didn't see that happen this year at all. For the summer months, we were about 100% growth year over year, which was just incredible for us. So we're really grateful for that.
I bet. But how come you had such great growth? Because as you know, this has been a questionable year economy-wise.
Absolutely. I feel like everything this year is kind of up in the air. And so it's just a lot of guesswork. I think, you know, one is that we just have incredible customers that really rallied around us and supported us with their dollars. And then the second reason I think is just a lot of, you know, what's going on in the world we're benefiting from somewhat, which I feel a little guilty saying when so many people are hurting. But we're e-commerce, you know, and people can't be with others that they love around them personally. And so they're sending a lot of gifts, and we're in the gifting space. And so I think e-commerce companies in the gifting space are benefiting from it. And I don't want to take that lightly or for granted.
Yeah, no, I get that. But look, you benefit from being in the gifting space and e-commerce on the consumer facing end. But what has the pandemic and you know, supply chain disruptions, which are global, right? What has that done to you?
Yeah, it's been incredibly challenging. So for us, for growers, for, you know, everyone in the supply chain space, it's just, like I said, a lot of guesswork, which is not where you want to be from a business owner standpoint. You know, you don't want to be making what feels like uneducated guesses a lot of the time. Right.
Another risk question, of course, has to be how you're taking care of workers and your suppliers. I mean, because the virus is still out there. I don't know what it's like in Ecuador, but I can't imagine it's great.
Yeah. So actually, I actually contracted the virus myself personally, and it was really bad. It lasted about 6 weeks. And, you know, there were moments where I didn't know if I was going to make it. It was really, really hard. And I can't say I'm grateful for having it because it's really hard, but I'm grateful for what I learned from it. Because I had COVID and went through it and saw what it could do for someone, you know, the biggest thing I want to do as a business owner is make sure that we're keeping people as safe as possible. So something we implemented was we test all of our employees every 2 weeks. And that's on our dime. We pay for that fully. And then the second thing we've done is make sure that if people are sick with it, that they don't have to worry about anything except for getting better. So we will pay them for the full amount of time that they're out. Mm. So we're really trying to do everything we can to make sure that we're keeping our team safe. And if they, you know, do get sick, that we take care of them while they're sick as well.
I'm going to guess that these policies are informed by you having been whacked by this thing for 6 weeks, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I saw how hard it was, and I don't want anybody to go through that.
Yeah. Last thing, and then I'll let you get back to work. Given everything you've been through this year and the prospects for this economy, roll the dice for me. What are you thinking for next year?
Yeah, I feel like that's what we're doing. We're rolling the dice totally. I've tried to do as much analysis as I can to be as wise as I can going into next year. But really, I have no idea. You know, I don't know if we're going to go into a recession, and it makes what I'm doing down here in Ecuador really hard right now to figure out. You know, I'm guaranteeing numbers of crops that we're going to grow, and what if there's a huge downturn next year and we still have millions of dollars of crops that we grew for it? So I don't know what next year looks like. I have a lot of hope. I hope that it, you know, that we're not in a place next year where I'm talking to you and I'm like, oh my gosh, what are we going to do?
Well, we will call you in a couple of months, Christina, and see how it's going. Christina Stemple, she is the founder and CEO of Farm Girl Flowers. Got her in Ecuador today. Christina, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me, Kai.
We'll get the latest report on construction spending on Thursday, another data point to help us figure out where this economy is headed. One of the ways we keep track of how things are going is by checking in with the 10 people from our series about the American labor force. It's called The United States of Work. Rocio Montano is 25 years old now. We first met her near the beginning of her career as a construction worker here in Los Angeles when she was living with her mom and saving up for a place of her own.
I was thinking about moving out this year, but since the whole pandemic happened and it's still going on, I would just rather stay at home and save, because I actually don't know what's going to happen or how much longer this is going to be. The biggest thing for me is that I'm still able to work. Even if it's slowing down a little bit because of the whole pandemic, I still have a job. Now I'm on a new project. And it's different because it's a parking structure. And now it's different working like right under the sun, even though it is harder, more intensive labor. Seeing how they work around concrete from preparing it and to putting everything, like all the rebar, like the reinforcement bars, how they tie it together. I think that's what's interesting. It's just exciting learning and seeing how different things work and how different things get put together.
That was Rocio Montano. She's helping to build a parking garage out by LAX. Coming up,
I was pleasantly surprised when I found a stash of tree-ripened peaches.
Oh, yeah. That's a good find, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 131 points on this Tuesday, 0.4%, 27,452. The NASDAQ down 32 points, about 0.2%, 11,085. The S&P 500 down 16 points, 0.4%, finished at 33.35. Beyond Meat, the meat alternative maker, rose better 9% today as it announced a tripling of the number of Walmart stores that are going to carry its patties. That deal lets Beyond Meat rely less on selling its product in restaurants, which are, of course, seeing reduced traffic because of the pandemic. Beyond Meat stocks more than doubled this year. Walmart shares basically flat today. After the close, Disney announced 28,000 layoffs, most of them part-timers at their parks. Virus, you know the drill. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Colleges are in session. Millions of students are in class, but not really in class, right? A lot of schools have decided the coronavirus presents too much of a risk to the students themselves, to faculty and staff, the community nearby, and the communities that schools would have to send students back to if they would have to shut down again, which has happened. Thing is, though, some versions of in-person college are happening. How? Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
Colleges and universities have a huge financial incentive to get and keep students on campus, especially private schools, says Emily Wadhwani, who covers higher education for Fitch Ratings.
About 80% of their revenue comes from tuition and student fees, so like dorm, dining, parking, those sorts of things.
She sees trouble ahead.
We do expect to see more closures as the fall season transitions into flu season. And what we hope to see really is a more orderly approach than what we saw in the spring.
So far this semester, though, higher ed's approach to the pandemic has been anything but orderly.
It is a bit of the Wild West out there.
Robert Franek is editor-in-chief of the Princeton Review.
There is no universal protocol about testing. Schools that are opening up, well-intentioned as that is, and then having to dramatically close or change policy is a huge financial burden on the school and crushing for students.
We don't have a great system in place to look at how universities and schools are doing in terms of controlling COVID.
That's University of Minnesota public health professor Kumi Smith. She says mandatory mask wearing and social distancing can prevent COVID spread, but she says on college campuses,
some of those guidelines are just impossible to enforce or not practical.
Smith says classes, dorms, dining halls, athletics, dance, and theater, the whole college experience is by nature communal. Expecting students not to hang out, go to parties, get close to each other is unrealistic.
It does seem cruel to shut down schools or to force kids to keep learning at home, but how much can we plead with individuals to please behave in a way that's really unnatural? And that goes against everything that we've signaled about what college should be like. It's a tall order.
One school trying to make it work is Wesleyan University, with 2,500 students in Middletown, Connecticut. Sophomore Kat Graylish flew back to Wesleyan from Portland, Oregon. She says despite the risk of getting COVID or being sent home again like she was last spring,
just going to a classroom and sitting down and having the professor actually be there in person is so nice.
Graylish says the rules are clear. Wear a mask, social distance, no visitors on campus. The school even provided an instructional video during orientation offering tips for dating without touching.
Solutions range from like listening to a podcast and drinking tea and then talking about it to, and I'm quoting, good old-fashioned phone sex.
Graylish has been reporting for the student newspaper on COVID compliance.
People are generally being pretty good, but that being said, I have definitely heard like rumblings of people having parties and stuff like that.
Students are wearing masks all the time on campus, at least all the time that I'm around.
Wesleyan President Michael Roth says the school's had about 10 positive tests since late August. And testing is rigorous, twice a week for all students and employees.
It's expensive, but you do have to test systematically, and you have to have the capacity for isolating students in a way that isn't punitive, so they'll do it, and so you can break the chain of transmission. Otherwise, you're just depending on luck.
Student Kat Graylish knows whether this works is mostly up to her peers.
I think there's a big sense of like either Wesleyan will get this right and we will stay here, or it's just completely going to fall apart right away.
And there's still a long way to go in this fall semester. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
So Mitchell was talking mostly about undergraduates and how the pandemic is changing that experience. Postgraduate education in this coronavirus economy, though, is no picnic either. Dozens of PhD programs across the country are saying they are not going to be admitting any new students for the next academic year. That is the one that starts in 2021. As Marketplace's Erica Barris reports, it is a temporary pause that could have some long-term effects.
Colleges and universities have a lot of additional costs these days. Personal protective equipment, remote learning infrastructure, COVID-19 tests. And with fewer students on campus, they have less money coming in. So says Carla Hickman with EAB, an education consulting company, schools are
making sure they can fulfill their commitments financially to the students who have already matriculated.
One way they can do that is by not admitting new students. Princeton sociologist Dalton Conley says that's the decision his department made in regards to PhD students.
It made more sense to suspend admissions for 1 year and have those resources than to be killed by 1,000 little cuts.
But students from poor backgrounds may not be able to wait for schools to restart admissions, so they'll pursue other careers. Suzanne Ortega with the Council of Graduate Schools says that's bad for diversity.
We're disrupting the flow from a more diverse undergraduate student pipeline to a less diverse graduate student pipeline.
Even undergraduates are likely to feel the effects, says Gwen Choder with the National Association of Graduate Professional Students, especially at big state universities.
Where the graduate students do the majority or close to the majority of the instruction of the undergrads, this might make it very challenging to continue to provide the same quality of education.
But this pause could also give graduate programs time to change. Princeton sociologist Dalton Conley says with field research suspended,
we have to rethink, we have to develop courses and a curriculum in, for example, virtual ethnography.
And that, too, will take resources. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
So here's an interesting tidbit in the how you feeling about this economy category. Spoiler alert, pretty good, it turns out. The Conference Board reported this morning consumer confidence in September as high as it's been since the pandemic started. Also, the jump in confidence from August to September, the biggest jump in 17 years. Chalk it up to that slowly declining unemployment rate. We will get the September jobs report Friday morning, by the way. We, though, have been checking in with some consumers, also regular listeners to this program, about what they have been consuming lately, and it seems sometimes spending a little money can bring a little bit of joy.
This is Kelly Koletsky in Columbus, Ohio. I wasn't quite ready to fly yet, but I felt like I really needed to fly home to check on my mom, who's 89 years old. And when I'm home, I always try and get my mom to maybe spend a little money on some new things, but she was raised during the Depression, and she won't spend money on anything except for groceries, and she only buys those when she has a coupon. But this afternoon, we were looking through an old dog-eared cookbook, and she said, you know, your father gave this to me about a month after we were married in 1954. So, you know, I think she's motivated by not wanting to spend on what she feels isn't necessary, but there's also a lot of value in the memories associated with a lot of the things that she has.
Hi, this is Ernesto from Chicago. Not a lot of new things, but what I did do recently was invest in some high-end French cookware, the enamel type, that I usually would not buy because, for the most part, it's just way too expensive. Now, I don't know if it's on sale at 50% because the businesses want to get rid of it before a possible future bankruptcy or not. I mean, that's how I see it. Also been buying some used camera gear, which never goes bad.
Hi, this is Ellen Murphy from Mission Hills, Kansas. And my coronavirus shopping stories have gone from being masked up and gloved up to just eyes glazed over, walking through the store, picking up like things off of a very strictly written list. So I was pleasantly surprised last week when I found a stash of tree-ripened peaches. And I can tell you that there is nothing like a fresh, late, late summer peach. When you slice into it in the morning and sit down to eat it, no matter what is coming across on the radio, it almost doesn't matter.
Hey, now we're sitting right here listening to you, Ellen. That was Ellen Murphy in Mission Hills, Kansas, with those summer peaches. Ernesto from Chicago, Kelly Koletsky in Columbus, Ohio as well. This final note on the way out today, CNN did the number crunching on this one, a breakdown of exactly where the $750 in taxes, income taxes that is, that the New York Times reports President Trump paid in each of the first 2 years of his presidency went. The Congressional Budget Office actually tells you what the dollar percentage breakdown is. So, of the $750, President Trump contributed $181.87 for defense spending, another $72.44 for veterans benefits and military pensions. Medicaid, health care for the poor and disabled, got $115.60. I could go on, the data does, but here's the last one we'll pick. Mr. Trump's annual contribution to paying interest on the national debt, which now stands north of $26 trillion, was $81.07. All right, we are going, but not without your Tuesday moment of economic context. It's a quickie and a little bit of a downer, TBH. John Williams, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, gave a speech today. Lots of inflation stuff, also interest rate stuff. Those are related, by the way. Here is the kicker, though. Williams said he figures the economy is going to be back close to where it was this past January in about, and this is a quote, in about 3 years' time. 3 years. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Samantha Fields, Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Eliza Mills, and Janet Wynn. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.